Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You hang up being there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told you that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And mess around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre, and that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat. I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively, and you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin. Well, hey, folks, and welcome to Solar Cabin Channel. I've got a neat little project for you. I call the Multi-Shack. This is one of my homeless housing solutions designs. And some of you probably don't know this. But I was homeless twice in my life. The first time was when I was trying to get into college, and I had lost my job and was waiting for my college funding to come in, and so I had to live in my truck. I lived in the cab of my truck for almost 2 months while I waited for my college funding to come in. And then again later in life when I got divorced and didn't have a job and was trying to get off grid, I lived for almost 2 years in a camp trailer. And, you know, there's a lot of people that, homeless people that have their pride. They want to maintain their independence. They don't want to live on welfare. They don't want to be caught up in the system. And, you know, all they need is a simple shelter. You know, some place to get out of the cold, to get out of the wind, to get out of the rain, while they get back on their feet. And so I know there's a lot of organizations out there that are helping the homeless, churches, nonprofits, and things like that. So I came up with this small structure design, which I call the multi-shack, because it has actually multi-uses to it. And it can be built very affordably. You can build this entire shack for under $200. And it is built on wheels. It can be put on either a 4x6 trailer, or you can build it on casters. Casters are a lot less expensive, but it still allows you to move this unit around. So you could store, you know, a bunch of these on a church parking lot, and then just when you need them, you can move them out to wherever you want the person to be using them. Casters are 4-inch casters. Each caster will hold up to 240 pounds, so they'll more than handle the weight for this structure here. Now, this structure is 6'5" from the peak to the bottom, 6'5". So, and even a tall person can stand upright inside this structure. The door is 1'6" wide and about 5'3" to the peak up there in the door. And the structure is 4 foot wide approximately and about 6 foot long, about 6 foot long by 4 foot wide, 6'5" to the peak. And this is constructed very inexpensively from 2x4 framing, which I'll show you, and uses, I would use 7/16 OSB or plywood. Either one would work for the siding on this. Now, a couple of the features here. I show this with dorm windows. The dorm windows are actually optional. You don't have to put dorm windows. You can just go with a flat roof surface if you want here. I show this with wood shingles, or you could use just plain old tar paper and roofing shingles. Any type of roofing shingles would work on this. Show it with a little flower box there just for effect. And on the backs and the front, I show this with these round windows, like boat-style windows, or you could put square windows. Either one works. I just like the effect of the round windows, the look of those in there. This does have an access panel on the back. Down here is an access panel. We'll just open this up so I can show you. Open up, take this one off. There we go. Now you can see inside the access panel. Underneath the seat and bed is storage, lots of storage underneath here for a propane tank,
one of those Port-a-Loo porta-potties, an ice chest over there you can see, okay? So there's good storage. This is about 18 inches high inside here and about 4 feet wide inside. So the structure, I'll show this with the door open. Let me just hide this door here. With the door open, you can see I've got this set up. Right now I've got it set up for seating. During the day, this would be used for seating purposes, okay? And I'm going to pull the side roof off here so I can show you inside that this has a very nice space for a person that maybe is going to school or working or just the table can be used for eating or whatever. So you've got approximately 6 feet of space on the inside here by 4 feet wide. And this table is actually part of the bed platform, which I'll show you. You just pull the 2x4 out, put it in one of these slots. It's in this 2x4 here. There's another one on the other side. You just drop the 2x4 into the slot, and then you take your bed panel and put it up on top of that, and then that becomes a table. Here you've got 2-foot by 4-foot cushions. There's three of these cushions that become your bed, or you can use a roll-up mattress pad underneath this that becomes your bed. But during the daytime, it becomes seating. It becomes a little mini couch in here, 4 foot wide. And now you've got a space for a student to do their studies, their work, or for having your meal, or if you're working on a hobby or a craft or something like that, you've got this nice little space. When you get out the door, you just lift the table up, put it back, put the 2x4 back in the bottom slots, put the table down, and then you turn it into a bed. And I'm going to show you what it looks like as a bed, too. So good headroom in this. I really like that it's got a very good space. This is an average person, 5'8" tall. You can see you've got lots of headroom here. You've got these nice dormer windows, which would give you lots of light, and also gives you a little bit more headroom up in this area right in here. A 6-foot person could stand up in the middle of this quite comfortably. Two people could actually share, sit side by side on this couch, or you can pull your ice chest cooler out, or someone could put a foldable chair on the other side here. So you could actually have two people sitting side by side or crossways next to each other here. So lots of space in this little place. So let me show you what the framing looks like on this first. And I'll just have to zoom in on this. Now this is all done with 2x4 construction to keep it inexpensive and easy to build. And then I would sheathe it with either 7/16 inch OSB or plywood. Either one would work. Now, it's got a floor frame, as you can see, made of 2x4s down here. Simple 2x4 frame, floor frame construction. And then your casters attached to the corners, not exactly in the corners, but they attach to the floor framing. And the casters have locks on them, so once you move this in place, you can just click on the locks and lock it in place so it won't be rolled around while the person is inside it. Now, this is the bed platform, and it has this back platform is 2'6" wide, and it is permanently connected. These are 1'9" wide platforms that can be raised up, and as you can see, these 2x4s right here, you put the 2x4 up in these other slots, and then you put these panels up on top, and they become either a table or a workspace. This one can go up here. This one can go on the end. It can go over the middle. So I gave you lots of options for the ways that you can organize this into workspace or living space as you need to use it. Very simple construction. It takes about 20 2x4s to build this. That's about it. And you're looking at about under $200 for all the material costs. And you could build one of these in a day. Seriously, you could build the complete unit in about a day. And now I'm going to show you on the inside how this can be used as a bed and also as a small business. So I'm just going to click off this. Okay, now I show this with the bed down, the door open so you can kind of get a peek inside here. Now, this is an uninsulated structure. You really don't need insulation in a small structure like this because the human body puts off about as much heat as a 90-watt light bulb. So in a small structure like this, your own body heat will actually heat it up. And for sleeping, you can either do these pads like this as mattress pads, or you can just get a sleeping bag pad or even an air cushion pad. to go underneath it. A sleeping bag pad would work fine because you can roll it up as you and use it as your seating. And a good heavy-duty sleeping bag would be all you would need in order to sleep very comfortably in here. As long as you don't have the wind blowing on you or the rain drenching you or snow piling up on you, you'll sleep very comfortably in a small structure like this. Your own body heat will heat it up. You could add a heater to these, but it really isn't necessary in these small structures. So I'm going to pull off the side roof, and I'm going to show you how much space this has inside it for a bed. It actually has a very nice bed that will sleep either one or two people. Pull this off here. Just hide this. Now, this has a 4 foot wide by 6 foot long bed. So even an average person can sleep in here. Even a tall person, fairly tall person, can sleep in here comfortably without being cramped. And it's 4 foot wide, so that's a very wide bed that will actually sleep two people. Two people could sleep in this space, all right? And it's 6 foot wide, and it's 4 foot wide and 6 foot long. This person I show in here is about 5 foot 8 inches tall, which is average height for most people. And here you can see the slots I was talking about. These platforms, which I'll show you, I'll take the bed off now. These two platforms are removable with 2x4s underneath them. You just take the 2x4, you put it in the slots that go across here, and then put these platforms up on top to make your table. And you can actually do a table on either end or one in the middle for a desk and table. Now, the ones on the ends I'll show you are used if you want to run a small business out of here, or if you want to organize this in a different way so that if you're cooking, you could put one of these tables on this end or on this end, and you could set up your cooking supplies and you can take care of yourself. You can cook a meal inside this little place right here. So 4 foot wide, 6 foot long bed, and then very adaptable with these platforms of 2x4s. You can just put them up and you can reorganize this any way you want during the daytime for whatever function that you're going to be using. Again, it has storage space underneath the bed and seating. You've got that nice access panel for you. You've got storage underneath there. And I really like the space in here. This would be enough adequate space if in an emergency, let's say that a city has a disaster, a fire like they just had in Canada wipes out all these homes, or you have a tornado tear through a place, or you have flooding or something like that, which we've all seen in the news, happens all the time, and suddenly churches are overrun with people that don't have housing. You know, if you had a bunch of these sitting around that would sleep at least two people, you could pull these out in a small area. You could set these up, and people would at least have shelter for, you know, survival until they can get into houses or shelter, bigger shelters or something like that. So that's another use for this type of structure here. So now I'm going to put the bed back on just to show you. And again, you can see this has really nice dormer windows. So you got really good light in this. And it's got an excellent sleeping space. It would be better for one person, but it would be adequate for two people. Okay? And, if you got little teeny kids with you, you could put, one adult and a couple of kids in there, too. You know, there's enough space in there to sleep comfortably, and you've got lots and lots of headroom. You're not going to bump your head or anything while you're sleeping. Doorway, 1 foot 6 inches wide, 5 foot 3 inches to the top up here. So lots and lots of good space in this. Now I'm going to show you how this can also be modified to be used as a small business. Okay, one thing I know about people that are homeless is they're also very creative, and a lot of them actually run little businesses in order to support themselves. A lot of them do recycling. They recycle cans and bottles and other stuff like that, or they pick up small appliances and stuff that they may find on the streets, or books or pictures or whatever, and they resell them, and that's how they support themselves. A lot of them are also very crafty people. They may make jewelry, or they may make wood crafts or something like that, or they may be artists. And so they have a way to support themselves, and so I think we ought to encourage that, because that helps them to develop sustainability. Not everybody is equipped to work in the regular workforce. Some people just aren't. but they're very industrious and can support themselves with a small business. And so I thought, well, this shack could also be used for setting up a small business. So what I did is I made this so that the window here can be hinged up, and I'll show this. The window on the one of the dormers, or both, can be hinged up out of the way. And then you've got room here to put a sales counter or little platform here where a person, this person is 5'8" tall, a person can stand in this window and they can operate a small business. They can talk to customers, they can take money, whatever, working right out of this small shack. Now this doesn't necessarily have to be for homeless people. If you wanted to run a hot dog or hamburger stand or sell your crafts or your books or, you know, whatever you want to do with this, maybe it's a ticket stand, I don't know. This little shack could be very useful for a lot of different purposes. That's why I call it a multi-shack, is because it can be used for many different purposes. But this would be great for a homeless person that has a craft that they make or recycle products or whatever. They want to sell them. They just hinge up the window, and they set themselves up a little business here to take care of customers. Now, this also shows inside how those tables can be reorganized. Here you can see I've lifted up the bed platform to put a table on this end, another table on this end, and you can use this for cooking in here. You can see I've got a little two-burner propane stove that you can set up on one of the tables up there so you can do your cooking. You can work on your crafts. This table just lifts off, the 2x4 lifts off if you need to get access to the door. Lots of good headroom, okay? Workspace in there. This can be modified many different ways for many different people of however you want to use it. So a very functional space in there. All right, so that is the multi-shack, all right? And let me just then hide this so you can get a better view of it. Again, can be built very inexpensively, around under $200 on casters, more expensive if you put it on a trailer. And I'm going to provide these plans for free because this is a project that I designed specifically for churches and nonprofit organizations to build shelters. And at present in the U.S., we have about 1.6 million homeless people that just need a simple shelter to live in. Or that's about 1 out of 200 people. And that's just in the U.S. There's a lot of people in other countries that are in even worse shape. And I really think a project like this would be great for helping the homeless people to have shelter while maintaining their independence and their pride. But it could also be used as disaster relief shelters. We could easily have a major disaster in a city where we have thousands and thousands of people that suddenly are homeless and we need to provide quick shelter. These would also work for that. It would be big enough space for two people to sleep and, to take care of their basic needs. And that's what this structure is about. So I hope you like this design. It's called the Multi-Shack. You can get the plans for free on my website, simplesolarhomesteading.com. Up at the top, look at Multi-Shack. Now, there is a button there if you would like to donate. Your donations are used by me to design structures like this and build small houses. I work with a lot of homeless people that don't want to be in the system, that want to build their own off-grid cabins and houses and places like that. I help them with designs and building those projects. So any donation, if you can donate, is very appreciated and will help with those projects. All right, folks, I hope you like this project called the Multi-Shack, and have a great day.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this because it remains the property of the client. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness, because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is, these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tons of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technicians, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Of course, it's cold. The beer tastes better. And so I get more customers.
All right, it's 11:15 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10:15 Central, then so on and so on. Wherever you are on the planet, if you're in Russia, it's 11 time zones. So Wherever you are in the world, you know what time it is. 16 minutes after the hour. Now, of course, most people that listen to this live broadcast, we're doing a live stream now, but most people listen on demand. So, whatever time you have, whatever time you have. Let's see. Today, we're going to talk about, we won't take up much of your time today, Wheeze. And that's spelled H-U-I, H-U-I, pronounced way. Actually, not we, but way, H-U-I. It's Taiwanese. It's like, I'll read what it is in a moment, which I mentioned it yesterday. Now, before we get to that, we're up to Tiny Town number 43. So we feature a few tiny towns a week. Sometimes we do one a day. Sometimes we might do two a week. But today we're up to 43, number 43 for us. And that's Kelowna, Colorado. Kelowna, Colorado. That's spelled C-O-L-O-N-A, one word, Kelowna, Colorado. Population varies between 36 people to 46 people. Somewhere, in that range, 36 to 46 people in that town. The town is 39 acres big. That's it. And Kelowna, I believe, it's Spanish for colony or colonist. So some people got together and they bought 39 acres of land, and now it's Kelowna, Colorado. That's something that an individual could do or a small collective of people can do. Something that you can do. But anyway, that's Tiny Town number 43. And for those of you who don't know, in the United States, there's about 108,000 towns. Only 10 of those have a population of 1 million or more people. We like to concentrate on what I call the tiny towns, towns that have a population. We haven't even hit 100 yet. Now, we've mentioned one town. All right, now, I haven't included it in our tiny town. It'll probably be in our small town section. We've been focusing on towns that have less than 100 people, which we call tiny towns. We might switch that to microscopic towns, but anyway. The largest one that we've mentioned, but we don't include it in our tiny town category, has been Yoder, Kansas. Yoder has a population of 165 people. That's not big at all, but I would call that a small town. These tiny towns are smaller in population. Typically, we haven't even hit one that's got 90 people in it yet. So we're up to 43, and my philosophy is instead of trying to get into the top 10 cities in the United States in those metro areas, where the opportunity is, where the more affordable living is at the opposite end of the spectrum. You got to do a 180, and then, you go up by degrees on that. Anyway, all right, so that's 43, tiny town. Kelowna, Colorado, don't have other information on it at this time. All right, Wheeze. Now, we're talking, and I'll read what a Wheeze is. They get together and they, let me read it as it is. I'm on Wikipedia. Oh, excuse me, not a Wheeze, but a Way. Spelled H-U-I. And this is a de facto language lesson I'm giving you right now. But WEI, H-U-I, is an informal loan club. It is a group-based rotating savings and credit club that is popular among many immigrant and migrant communities throughout the United States and Taiwan. So I guess it's Wei, spelled H-U-I, pronounced Wei. It's traditional Chinese or Mandarin. And in China, they have two primary languages of the Chinese language, Mandarin and Cantonese. All right, so a lot of these, well, I don't know, things have changed so much. A lot of these Chinese restaurants are now owned by Vietnamese, but a lot of them have formed white ways, H-U-I, and, you know, families get together and buy these. Okay, process. The basic premise and model of a group of close friends and family members as social capital, they're not dealing with strangers, coming together once a month, or whatever you decide on, once a month, once a week, once a day. But once a month, contributing a fixed amount of money into the pool, into the money pool. Every time one member of the club will be chosen to withdraw the entire lump sum from the pool, often for the purposes of down payments towards houses, cars, or to start a business. Now, let's give an example of this. Let's say you have four families. They can be four, and in this case, I'm going to pick three ethnic groups here. Gujaratis from India, and you got four families, and each four are pitching into the pot every month until all four. Now, their particular niche market here in the United States are hotels and motels. Okay, Gujarati family number one. You know, they're pitching in. I don't know how much they're pitching in, but let's say $1,000. All right, so they've got $4,000. That's the pot at, you know, every new month, and they're able to get into a small little off-brand, no-name motel. But that motel might have 20, 30 units, but they need $4,000 to get in. So the first one gets in at a no-name hotel, then they put another $1,000 in a month. The next one, they get maybe a Super 8 motel. The next family, same process, they get a Motel 6 motel, and the last one gets, man, I don't know, Holiday Inn. All right, and that's what they do. All right, let's switch over to another part of Asia, because the Gujaratis are out of South Asia, India. Their niche that they're going to go in for their way, away, spelled H-U-I, is they want to do Chinese carryouts, or Chinese carryout restaurants. And the same process, each one throws in, let's say, $2,000 a month, all right? So that's $8,000 in the pot between four families. And if it's, you know what, let's put it at five. So that's $10,000. And each one of them decides to get their own Chinese restaurant, carryout. Now, it can be individually named or it can be under a collective brand name in a particular market, town, or what have you. All right? They do that. Now, the thing is, I don't know about what kind of revenue these – I can find it out – what these Gujaratis make on these hotels or motels on a monthly or yearly basis. But the average Chinese carryout in the hood here in the United States they take in, on average, $1,100,000 a year. And when you go into them, you know, boots on the ground, you see generations working together, mom, pop, grandparents. And, you know, last time I walked into one, which was last week, you know, they had a, well, he was about maybe 12 years old. He was doing home workout. It was lunchtime. He was doing homework. The rest of the family was, you know, running the business. So, now, another ethnic group we want to pick out, Arabs. I know, like in Detroit, the gas stations, the parties. Now, in Detroit, they call convenience stores party stores. Same concept. Families put the, you know, they put it, you know, three, four, five families, whatever it might be. And that's how they get it going. Anyway, the process, once again, is a model of close friends or family members. That's social capital. And they put it together. Initial role of the group leader in a particular way usually is initiated by a trusted figure or influencer within the community. That person is considered the group leader and is in charge of recruiting and vetting all participating members. Now, with electronics these days, you can do things differently. You know, because you could have a group leader, but you can set up the rules the way you want to. In other words, if somebody's setting up a store, all right, then instead of sending your money to one particular trusted group leader, you can send your share into, I mean, if it's a convenience store, or party store, as they call it in Detroit, you know, if you need to stock the store, you know, you send your $2,000 or $1,000 or whatever that figure might be into the supplier that supplies bread, mayonnaise, sodas, beer, whatever it might be. You send it to those suppliers direct, and they those suppliers deliver it to your particular or whatever store is going to be funded that month. So with it, you know, with social media and electronics, you can do things a little bit differently. And then, of course, the group leader just monitors that everything is getting delivered and all that. You got full transparency with everybody. But using Asian communities, that's what they call it, is also a form of collaborative finance. And then Wikipedia has Suzu and all this stuff. We'll read from that, too. Suzu, spelled S-U-S-U, is a type of informal savings club arrangement between a small group of people who take turns by what they call throwing hands, as partners call it. The name is used in Africa, especially West Africa and the Caribbean. The basic principle is that each member of the group makes a standard contribution to a common fund once per, when you say at the time, it could be once per week, once per month, for the aggressive ones, once per day. The basic principle is that each member of the group makes a standard contribution to a common fund for a specific period of time. Then each period, the total contributions are dispersed to a single member. And like I said, with electronic media, you know, like I said, if you got a store you're doing, it could be a house that you're putting up or building, whatever it might be. You know, you discuss which way you guys want to split that up or disperse of the funds. And another, TADA, that's the Latin American version of this, TANDA, and or Rotating Savings and Credit Association. So read those and get ideas from them, and then tailor make it for the way you want it done. All right, now we're doing a small one, $200 four people at $50 each. I threw in the first 50. And the way I like it done is, okay, I'll just, you know, $50 worth of material. Like, it was building materials, $50 worth of building materials that, you know, you just send it directly to Home Depot, Lowe's, Menards, Ace, whatever, or Facebook Marketplace. And then that particular supplier will send it or ship it to the location of a particular club member that, in this case, building the project. All right, so you pay the supplier, then the supplier makes the delivery. I think that's a clean and efficient way to do it, but it's only limited to your imagination and which, you know, what works out best for your particular way. Once again, that's something done in Eastern Asia. And Eastern Asia would be the countries of Japan, China, Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and possibly maritime Southeast Asia, which would be the Philippines, Papua New Guinea, those places. So Indonesia, those places. But, you know, it's and although it might appear to be easier to form these groups, but they operate off of social capital. That's family and friends. So if you miss payments or late, you stand a strong chance of being ostracized or banished from the community. So that's why a lot of these groups are successful with it, because it's the social pressure. They don't. It's more pressure than dealing with a bank. So that's why a lot of these groups are successful. They come to countries and like the Gujaratis, which would be broken down into, that's an ethnic group out of South India. The Patels, and not all Patels, but a whole lot of them, and their men families, AMI, they have their system of social capital finance, of, you know, getting things done. Now, in this country, the United States, and the Amish, the Mennonites, the other groups too. I'm just naming some of the higher profile people. Okay. And our ways, once again, H-E-Y, that's how it's spelled, will be based on e-commerce. Matter of fact, Monday, we're going to talk about, what do we have for Monday? Oh, Walmart Villages. Next time you walk through Walmart, I want you to look at Walmart in a different way. Like, if you go through the different sections of Walmart, all right, you go through, like, the clothing, like, the men's clothing section. Here's how I want you to look at that men's clothing section. That there's some village in Asia, some small village that you have never heard of, that they've made those clothes, shoes, clothes, sweatshirts, shorts, socks. They're little small, what I call Walmart villages. Now, Walmart doesn't own the villages, but there's some small villages that their livelihood, that's what they do. They make those shoes that you see in Walmart, the T-shirts, the shorts, and the whatever you see in the men's section. Think of it. Matter of fact, go online and find a little village in It used to be called Burma. I forgot the new name of it. But look at matter of fact, look it up now. Myanmar. Okay. Myanmar. Okay. Formerly known as Burma. There's a small village in Burma, or some villages, which I call them Walmart villages. Once again, what Walmart didn't, those are not villages owned by Walmart, but they contract, they buy, look, matter of fact, I'm looking at, where did it go? I'm looking at it right now. I have a tent that I'm looking at right now in the foyer right by my front door. It was made in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. So when you go through Walmart, next time you go through Walmart, now that's the, you know, the women's section, you know, imagine a village that has plenty, I mean, they have these ladies, and I guess some men, that they know how to sew. So they're sewing the clothes that you see in the women's section. The tents that you see in Walmart, a lot of that comes from South Asia and Southeast Asia. There are villages of people some of these villages, all they do is make socks and underwear. That's it. But it sustains that village where they can eat. They can have their flat-screen TVs. Matter of fact, somewhere on the planet, there is a village, and I'll give you a wise, on the continent of Africa, there are villages. South Asia, there are villages. China, there are villages. Southeast Asia, there are villages where companies like Walmart, that's why I call Monday's podcast will be, that'll be titled Walmart Villages. And there's an audio I've played on here quite frequently called Factory. What's the name of it? I should know because I play it all the time. Look up Foxconn, F-O-X-C-O-N, on, or look up the... you can get I bought the digital copy. I just went out and bought it. But you can watch it for free on YouTube, Factory City. It's about 45 minutes long. One particular village, I mean, they got a major operation where they have a school. I mean, they train people, their schools, on how to make a coffee machine or a microwave. They have schools in... Now, this happens to take place in Taiwan, but there are schools in China and different parts of the globe where a lot of your household items, some people go to college or go to school and get a degree in psychology, where other people go to school to learn how to make teapots and coffee pots and whatever gadgets or uses things that you have in your house. And... you know, they're making it, and they make so many per month per day, and they just ship it out globally. I call those Walmart villages. Walmart doesn't own them, those villages. But they buy from the manufacturers who make these products. It's just like, Air Jordans, the popular footwear that's helped make Michael Jordan a billionaire. Well, Michael Jordan himself does not manufacture that shoe. Air Jordan is a private label. Now, anybody within the sound of my voice, you can own your own private label of tennis shoe or anything you can think of. All right. What now, the company that's in charge of making sure that shoe gets manufactured, the Air Jordans, is they have a licensing agreement, is Nike, N-I-K-E, which is a shoe company. But Nike does not make shoes. They don't manufacture shoes. They contract or subcontract with a company out of Asia to make those shoes, to make Nike shoes and to make the other brands like Air Jordan or whatever shoes they have out there. They actually manufacture those shoes in Asia because of you can get it at, you can manufacture in that part of the world and in Africa at a dramatically lower price. All right. And then you have it made in those markets, but then you have the shoe, because you have some people, all they do is, now let's break down the Air Jordan by component parts. And we're going to really break this down for kids, because we're going to, because there's a lot of kids that want to play sports, you know, basketball, football, soccer, whatever. And a lot of them are attracted to those sports because of the money that some of these athletes make. But once we break it down to you, who makes more money, the person who makes the shoes or the shoe parts? Because there are companies in Southeast Asia, there are villages in Southeast Asia, once again, I call these Walmart villages, where they make shoestrings. That's all they do is they make shoestrings. And they make more money making shoestrings than the person who you know that's in the NBA or the NFL that actually wears those shoestrings. That's just off shoestrings. Another part, we're going to deconstruct a shoe. There are people around the planet, they're making millions, if not billions of dollars on shoestrings. That's just one part of the shoe. There's another company or another village, they're making millions and billions of dollars on just constructing the sole of that shoe. There's another village that's sustaining itself, families going to college. Those shoes are what colored, what, red, black, and white? There's somebody making a bunch of money off of that. So we're going to take a look at that, like, say, what I call them Walmart villages. And you can do the same thing over here. Now, the selling of the product, that deals with, what do you call it, e-commerce, and the e-commerce villages that, you know, these villages, they make something, they sell clothes, they grow food, they manage stuff. And then they go online using their smartphones, and they sell it that way. There's a lot of them, but I'm going to just name two of them. Viya, V-I-Y-A. She's known as an influencer, and I believe she's out of South Korea. And then there's another dude, Austin Lai. That's his Americanized name. Austin Lai, spelled L-I. And these two, on occasion, when they go online using smartphones, they do like $200 million in sales within a 24-hour period of time. Viya, spelled V-I-Y-A, she sells everything from houses, food, dresses, shoes, cars, to rocket launchers. Whereas Austin Lai, he sold on a consistent basis like lipstick. He sells a lot of things, but lipstick is one of his go-tos. Give him 15 minutes. Give him 10 to 15 minutes on a smartphone for a live stream, and he'll sell maybe 15,000 units of lipstick. Him and a smartphone. Him, a smartphone, and an internet connection. So, want to detail on these people in these villages. So, you can set up the same thing where if you want a daily income, you can set up a way or a Suzu. Same thing, just different cultures. Do you want to earn it daily, weekly, monthly? All right. So, and then we'll have our own boots on the ground. Interactive classes on all this stuff, starting on September the 4th, which you'll be here very soon. So, Monday, make sure you tune in, and we're going to be talking about Walmart villages. Once again, these are villages. Walmart doesn't own these places. They're not even, that's the name I gave them. And a lot of things in Walmart, just go to the different sections of Walmart, all right, and a lot of those things, some of the things were American-made, but a lot of those items that are in Walmart were made in little villages, even the ones that have an American-made label on it. Those items were most likely made in some village in Africa and or Asia and assembled in the United States. It's just like the big three in Detroit, automakers, you know, Ford, GM, General Motors, and Chrysler. They don't manufacture anything. Detroit's an assembly plant for those three. The parts, the seats, the ashtray, the cigarette lighters, let's say the typical car might have 30,000 different parts. Those parts are made in different parts. Some of those parts are made in the United States. Some of those parts are made outside the United States. But they get shipped to Detroit, and Detroit's basically an assembly city. So that stuff that you see in Walmart, you know, the parts might, what you see is stuff that has been assembled somewhere else. And, you know, basically Walmart's a distribution center, to be honest about it. Nothing wrong with that, but I'm just saying. And the dollar store and the Dollar General, and we can go on down the line. When it comes to tools, Harbor Freight. That's basically an outlet center or distribution center. But if you trace the origins of Harbor Freight, it's all online. I'm just saying this to say this. You, whoever you is, can do the same thing. Not good English, but it is what it is. All right, let's see. 813 area code, your mic is open if you got anything to throw in for today. I'm done with my rant.
Yeah, just I want you to announce the call-in number for anyone that wants to make a comment that's not online to see the number to call in. So it might be in the car or, you know, whatever, listening. And then we also have area code 773 is on the line with us. And then announce to everyone about Monday on the Victory Station, WCGL Radio.
Yeah, that's Monday, September the 4th. Yeah, Monday, September the 4th, not this coming Monday. Okay, the Monday after next. We'll be, it's a different show. Now, it's not going to be It's My House. Because right here on, let me explain the distinction. All right. It's My House, a DIY housing TV. We're on internet, as you well know, for the last 9.5 years. We can talk about anything. We can use colorful language. And that's what we do here. However, starting on Monday, September the 4th. Not next Monday, but the Monday after next. Monday to September the 4th at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we'll be on live on WCGL out of Jacksonville, Florida. For those times, you can catch us online by going to WCGL. They have an online presence. On that program, which will be radio, okay, although heard on the internet, but we're going through radio. We're sticking AM and FM radio. We're no colorful language, and it's a contemporary gospel station. And on that program, which is titled essentially Abiding Faith Housing Ministries, we hang our nail on this. Isaiah 65:21, we shall build houses and live in them. So that whole thing is that program, which will be just an hour long once a week, will be about how you can, if you don't know anything about building houses, how to build a house without previous experience, and how to solve personal finance challenges that you might have by just learning how to build a house and then solve financial problems that way. But that's on starting Monday, September 4th, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That'll be live. And it's that station's out of Jacksonville, Florida, so we'll have boots on the ground interactive activities, including classes and retreats for hands-on in that particular market. Now, if you want radio in your market, let us know, but that's our flagship station starting on September the 4th.
Mm-hmm. And then I just want to make an announcement that we are broadcasting in mainstream media. And so when you call in on the line, you want to be in a quiet place, no background noise, moving around. If you are moving around in a lot of stuff like that, mute your microphone. And so, and then also, if you have a battery, you know, the smoke alarm battery that needs to be replaced, and you know how it chirps, if I hear that in the background, I will just automatically mute you, because we are broadcasting directly in mainstream media, on radio, on TV, on Roku, and all of that. So quality control, a little housekeeping. I just wanted to make that announcement. And then, that's all.
All right, so we'll announce it every time we're on, but so that's on Monday, September the 4th. So, and like I say, that'll be a boots on the ground, because we're looking to touch ground. We're working for at least 10 stations, but that's the first one we jump off the ground. So that'll be heavily focused on boots on the ground for Jacksonville, Florida. But you can listen to it because they do have an online station anywhere on the globe. Then now we'll be doing other boots on the ground radio as well, but that's the first one we'll be actually boots on the ground, because if you're listening to us right now in Timbuktu, and we do have listeners in Timbuktu, but they're not coming to a live event, so we're establishing boots on the ground radio stations that are deep into the community, where we can actually demonstrate and meet people face-to-face and actually do these bill projects that we've been talking about for some time. So Jacksonville, Florida will be the first one, and then we have other areas that we're lining up, but that's the first one that's in stump. So anyway, Monday we're going to be talking about Walmart villains. And like I said, once you go through Walmart, a lot of the things that were made in Walmart, some of those things that were probably made in Walmart could be made in somebody's garage. You know, but they've got quality control, and they learn how to get it into these stores and sell it. So on that note, that's all I have for today. Let's see, what do we have on? You know what? Oh, we're not going nowhere. I'm adding time to the clock here. Let me add time to the clock. I'm going to play a little bit about Factory City. And let me see. Now, they do have, in this country, they do have factory towns in the United States. Some of them are left in the, what do you call it, the Rust Belt, you know, states like Indiana or what have you. I'll talk a little bit about that right now.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe, but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away. But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock. Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day. When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but Yupa wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. He finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, six production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized department only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly line. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work, and there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute, and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo,
juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Youpert could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done. And when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xingming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xingming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Lee runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin, and Lee needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, he still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasoning that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers.
rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all.